Hey, it's Conrad Thompson, and you're listening to Arn. And of course, we couldn't do it without the Hall of Famer himself, the founder of the Four Horsemen. Ladies and gentlemen, here he is, Arn Anderson. Arn, how are you, man?
I'm awesome. Am I getting it down?
You're getting it down, baby. You're getting it down. And I'm so glad that we're able to get down with your old friend, Mr. Tully Blanchard. Tully, thank you so much for joining us today.
Guys, it's my pleasure, and I'd do anything that Arn asks.
Well, we're going to push that to the limit today.
Things have really changed over the last 25 years. What the hell? I'm getting set up, I can assure you of that.
I don't think so.
Well, I'm so delighted to have you both here. This is a very special bonus episode. Gosh, there's so much to talk about today, Mr. Blanchard.
Please call me Tully.
Okay, Tully. I don't think you have done too much of this with Arn, right? I think you guys once upon a time appeared on Chris Jericho's podcast, and that's probably it, right?
Yes. Yeah, we have not been together on an interview or TV show or anything until we appeared on AEW, and this is the second podcast.
How cool is that? After all these years, you guys are getting to work together again with AEW.
Well, it's still a little surreal for me because I was gone completely from the wrestling business for 25 years. And to now be back in and on television and, getting to see Arn every couple of weeks and sit down and chat with him and kind of the way we used to do things when we'd be on those long car rides. And so things back and forth and it's really neat.
It is neat. And I guess we should start talking about how you guys first met. The first time I saw you guys together was with Jim Crockett Promotions. Is that the first time y'all ever bumped into each other as far as you recall?
Yeah. That's when Arn came to work for Crockett in late 84.
Early 85, March.
Early 85.
But I was gonna say, not to interrupt you, I did meet you one time when I first started and I was working for Watts, and you and Gino came over and did the Dome show in 82.
Oh, really?
And I was just an underneath guy with 3 months experience, and it was nice to meet you. Pleasure to meet you. Go back.
Wasn't rude, was I?
Nope. I went back, sat in the corner and minded my own business, but it was,
well,
that was the
I first probably
time.
Went in the other corner.
That was the first time I'd actually met you, but spend any time with you at all was with Crockett for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. When you and Ole were tag teaming, and then we moved on in and you named the Four Horsemen. So, and then history's proven that. So
yeah, history was made, man. Let's talk about that. I guess, was that all just from your perspective, Tully, a happy accident, the formation of the Horsemen?
Oh, it was absolutely, I mean, for my part, I mean, it was crazy because you had Ole and Arn and Flair was their cousin. So, it was a family deal, and it was my only entrance to the whole deal was I was wrestling Dusty. So when they wanted to have all those 8-man tag matches and Dusty was in them, I was very fortunate to be we're putting Tully in there. So, since I was the only one outside the family that was part of it, it was probably a double accident for me.
What about from your perspective, Arn? I mean, it's pretty special to see the Horsemen come together and know what they accomplished, and you famously named them. I guess to catch some of our younger listeners up, the idea was Flair was sort of a cousin of the Anderson clan, right? And then Tully just happened to have JJ as his manager, and ta-da, here we are.
it was one of those rare things that we were all just put together on a promo. Now I was the rookie. I was just trailing, listening, eyes open, ears open, mouth shut at that time anyway. And I was just looking around and I'm going, God almighty, there's Tully Blanchard, who was positioned as top heel in the company already. Of course, Ole Anderson, you know, learning from him and being with him was, whether people believe it or not, was a honor and a learning experience. I mean, I learned so much as far as credibility and believability from Ole. And they put us on that promo, and people ask me all the time, you know, how did you come up with that? I mean, is that something you had been thinking about, or is it something from the office? You know, it was, I do not know to this day. It's just, I was looking at us and I was in awe. You know, I was sitting there with my jaw on the ground in awe of who I was out there on that promo with. And it just popped into my head, you know, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and the destruction, and, you know, how the promo went down and all that. But it was purely accidental. I mean, it really was, because no one in the office said anything to us about it. It just popped in my head and I threw it out there, and we concluded the interview, and Tony Schiavone walked right up in my grill and he said, Jesus, Arn, you just named you guys. And I went, okay, yeah, maybe, yes. And I don't remember when this started, but I bet you it was within a week or two of that promo. Tully, do you remember?
I don't remember when that happened either, but the thing that is the test that you could, the litmus test, is the fact that from 1985 to now, you can still put Arn, Tully, Rick, and Barry at an autograph show, and the line is out the stinking door 30 years after the fact. And I don't think any other group can do that. And it's simply because when Arn put the spark on the fire, the fans ran with it. It was something that they wanted. When they started having those signs and holding them up at ringside, and Four Horsemen and Four Horsemen this and Four Horsemen that. And I don't know that it can ever be duplicated, but it was the most fun time in this business that I had experienced.
Oh, for sure.
What's fun about it too, is it didn't come from a writer's room. You know, it was just organic. It just happened. And it feels like a lot of the magic that happened under Dusty Rhodes' watch was that way. We've talked a little bit with Arn about how when he first came into Crockett, he met with Dusty, and Dusty's instructions were, go get over. What can you tell us about working with Dusty? What are your memories of coming in and working with him?
Well, the only real thing other than just talking was when he first came in, it was an instantaneous fire. And he called me into a private little meeting and he told me, he said, you've been a booker before. And he said, what would you do to get this thing going? And I said, you got to put the best against the best. That's the way you get any place going.
Right.
And so he agreed and he said, well, Wahoo wants to wrestle me. And I said, well, I said, that's fine. But I said, if it was me doing it, and it's the only time ever that I ever jumped myself up in there, I said, I'd put Wahoo against Flair and let them go beat the crap out of each other. And I said, I'd put me against you because I can make you look really, really, really good. And I was fortunate that Dusty did that. And over the next 4 years, you know, whenever things were going down, we did some sort of a thing where, you know, we had an I Quit match but the First Blood match or the Win Baby Doll match or whatever the case might be. And those were all a very successful period until Arn and I went to the WWE.
Working with Dusty, Arn, has got to be a bit of a treat, especially because, you know, you said it was some of the most fun you ever had. But now it's come full circle. You're getting to work with Cody. Did you ever think that, you know, your career would really just become parallel with the Rhodes family as long as it has?
Well, you know, before we skip over, you know, how we got from there to here, I think it's important that we go back and realize a couple things. It's like, from that promo going down and saying Four Horsemen, like I said, I don't remember if it was a week, but it was probably no more than 2 weeks. Again, this thing popped in my head and we started doing it. And within a 2 week time slot, we went from never being together with any association other than the story with the Andersons or Flair being family to 2 weeks later, that crowd that was still down, business was had not came up yet. It had not caught fire yet, but there was just some inklings and some things that people were doing that the Four Horsemen deal right out of the chute. I mean, it just flamed up and you've never probably seen guys that were just put together that didn't come in together as a team or anything that in 2 or 3 weeks time, it was already catching fire. And that's an amazing, amazing accomplishment if you think about it. But if you look around, our audience was, you know, they knew who Ole Anderson was. They knew who Tully Blanchard was. Tully had been there for a little bit and had already staked his claim in the company. You know, and Ric Flair and this rookie standing out there who looked like Ole, had to, you know, was trying to work like Ole a little bit and you implement some of his style, you know, to just suddenly be grouped together. I guess that's why it worked. Once they stuck us together, there was no turning back. And it just built and built. And with JJ, I mean, the thing that benefited everybody from the fans to the baby faces to us was the fact that no matter who they stuck that mic in front of, and we had no set order of how we were going to go. It was just somebody would step up to that mic and there was nothing lost on any one guy that did the talking. When it was said and done, everything was covered and it was covered in a very eloquent and vicious way, just depending on which guy you handed the mic to. And it just immediately caught fire. And to this day, you know, think about that 3 weeks time.
Right.
Amazing.
It's also interesting to think, you know, cause I think most of us, you know, fans listening to this, we think this Horseman run was, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. It's really about 3 years, right? I mean, from when you first called it the Four Horsemen to when y'all left to go work for Vince, it's only about 3 years. Time flies when you're having fun, right?
Oh boy.
Yeah. And you got to remember, Conrad, a lot of those, you know, Carolina towns when this thing first started, we were going to weekly or bi-weekly, 3 or 4 times a month, we were going to some of these towns, which is amazing because every week you got to bring them something different because the audience remembers. They remember, you know, what the structure of a match would have been. They may not remember everything or even most of it, but if you go out there and you don't change it up and you don't, you know, give them a change in your story or change in your opponent or change in the style of match you have, you know, they'll know. So it was demanding and it was challenging, but what it made you learn how to do more than anything, you don't hear this being emphasized. You had to learn how to work. and work with everybody and anybody from different skill levels. It wasn't one of those things that you might consider doing. If you wanted to survive, much less thrive, you know, you better learn how to work. And we all, you know.
Yeah, you talk about that and talk about the skill levels of a people, because back in those days on Saturday morning when we'd wrestle some of those guys that were coming over from Alabama, the skill level was zero. And you had to go out there and still have a decent match so that people would watch your TV show. And then in the house shows, you had to wrestle Robert and Ricky and Magnum and Dusty. And, you know, even when we had some of the heel matches against the Midnight Express, those kind of guys. And you had to make it all believable. And it was very taxing and trying.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Horseman days in regards to Ole. I don't think we talk enough about Ole. Ole was obviously an old school guy, the former tag team partner of not only Arn Anderson, but Lars before him and Minnesota Wrecking Crew, and owned a territory, an old school rough and tumble gruff wrestling guy. And it feels like, you know, because of the shoot interview era, or maybe because he's not active on social media, I don't know. I don't think he gets enough credit for his contributions. What say you, Tully?
He was part of the Horseman thing for maybe what, 6 months, Arn?
First go around, yes. And he told us coming in, it was almost, he let everybody know there was no mystery that his son was wrestling at UTC, and he was hell bent on when wrestling season came around, he was going to take some time off and go watch his son wrestle. That was something that was a discussion with the office. It certainly was not a discussion with me. You might've been privy to it, but I knew that was already out there. But it's one of those things, well, hey, that's 6 months down the road. A lot can change. And as that thing flamed up like it did and got so hot, you know, it's like when Ole said, okay, you know, wrestling season's here, I'm going to take some time off. In those days, you wouldn't have dared take a time off for a number of reasons. We're starting to make money. We were getting over big time. And if you stepped out of that slot, somebody was going to step in and you may never get it back. A lot of variables.
Oh yeah. But the Ole was a tremendous star. When him and Gene, I mean, you just put those guys, on the card back in the 70s, 60s, 70s. I mean, it was big business, there. And, you know, we all gleaned off of Ole just in the dressing room, things that he would say, things that he would do in the ring, the same thing. And, you know, I think that Arn and I were a little bit, we could think outside of a box a little bit more with some of the baby faces and stuff like that we had to perform with. We adapted more to our opponents, whereas our opponents had to adapt more to Ole. Would I be safe in saying that?
Yeah, you would. And Ole made you earn his niche. If you want to put in a capsule, what Ole Anderson was to the industry, this is my take on it, watching it from the apron, firsthand. He didn't give you anything. Anything you got in a match with Ole, you had to earn it. And that, I mean, you had to chop him down. My God. And you literally had to half-ass out-wrestle him to get an advantage on him. And you could see that. The audience could see that. And it was like from the second he locked up with a guy, it was a struggle. And you felt that. And there were a lot of guys that had to step outside, like you said, Tully, of their style and work more to his style if they were going to make it competitive, because he was going to bring it to you.
He wasn't changing either.
No, he was not. And there was no room for error. He stuck with his style, and you're right. Him and Gene, it was never lost on me. I was given a gift. I was an Anderson before I was a horseman. And I knew that Gene and Ole, you know, and I have no, you know, I don't talk about Lars because I never saw those guys work as a team, and I don't know anything about it, and I don't want to be dumb saying something that I have no knowledge of. But Gene and Ole were as good a team and as over a team as probably there was in the business. And I stepped into that spot. It was a gift for me. And I knew that. I was just a rookie. I had no business being in that spot with the amount of experience that I had. And then when you guys stepped into that picture, I mean, I was just like walking around with my mouth gaped open, because all top guys in the industry, not just in the company, but in the industry, there's Ric Flair, there's Tully Blanchard, there's J.J. Dillon. It's like Ole Anderson. It's like, my God, how did I get here?
Yeah, but one thing, Arn, that you may not have had the time experience, but we could all see talent personified in you, and you were an absolute sponge learning everything. So you fit in absolutely perfectly.
Well, I appreciate that. I know that I tried my best to just listen and learn and watch, and I learned something. And I mean a ton of something from every one of you guys, every one of you.
Well, let's talk about another member of the Horsemen. There was a fella running around back then named Ric Flair that, if we're going to talk about the Horsemen, we probably got to talk about, give us some Ric Flair memories, Tully, your favorite Ric Flair stories, either in the ring or out of the ring.
I thought you said we weren't going to get dicey.
We don't have to, which is why I left it open-ended. Or go wherever you want to go.
Well, fortunately for me, I have forgotten most of the Ric Flair stories, and it's kind of just a blur in the past. But it is, I can remember when they were grooming Flair to be the world champion, and he came down to San Antonio to wrestle a couple spots when my dad and I had our own territory. And you know, Ric was a guy like Arn. I mean, you could just see the natural talent and flamboyance, and from the first time they stepped in the ring when they were still relatively newcomers to the profession, and you could just see the excitement that they could generate with fans. And Flair was a member of the Horsemen, and it was not Ric Flair with leading the three horses. We were all equal parts of the Four Horsemen, which I think is a unique situation, whereas a lot of other teams either were led by the manager or led by one of the guys or something like that. But it was, you know, we could stand alone on the U.S. championship, or when Arn and I were the world tag team champions, you know, that kind of stuff, it was just as strong as Flair being the world champion. And that was one of the unique things about the group when we were put together.
Arn, do you think you guys would have ever been a tag team, you and Tully, if it weren't for the Horsemen? I mean, at different times you were both single stars holding individual singles titles, but then I think through the Horsemen, you guys became a tag team, and obviously it became a tag team that so many teams, even to this day, pattern their style after. Would it have happened without the Four Horsemen?
I believe everything happens because of timing. Timing in this business is everything. And sometimes it's just be it not being booked and walking in the back door and having your gear with you, and some guy shows up and he's got 105 temperature and can't wrestle, and you get a chance to, hey man, you got your gear? And a guy gets a break like that. I truly believe us being on that interview that day was the launching pad of something great. And if that promo had never happened, then that thought would have never happened in my head. And who knows? I don't think so. It was meant to be that we're on that promo together that day, and it just gelled. It just worked. And I think that the key component, there was two key components to us. Rick Style was Rick Style. He's the consummate showman, entertainer. Tully Blanchard was a technician that was very unlikable to the fans. He was one of those guys that not one person in that building could stand him, and they wanted him to get his ass kicked. Ole Anderson was the real tough guy of the group, and I was somewhere trying to blend my style, bring the action that Tully Blanchard brought to the ring or to a match, and blend it in with a little Ole Anderson, and hey, not only that, you want to kick my ass, you're going to have to kick my ass, because there ain't going to be no easy path to get there. And we were all so different that you could take pieces out. You mentioned earlier about working with Dusty. If Tully and Magnum went off to headline one of the towns, and Flair was out traveling, defending the world championship somewhere else, they could send me and Dusty to one of the other towns, and it was just business as usual. The guy was over. No matter what you say, he was a huge star. And going out wrestling him, to me, I was just, you know, I was starstruck. It translated to adrenaline for me being in the ring with Dusty Rhodes. And I could figure out 50 ways to bounce off of that elbow. And that was the key to getting a match with Dusty over, man. You just fed him and fed him and fed him. And you finally got him down, and the people went ape shit. You didn't keep him down long, and he kicked your ass again, and he beat you. And it absolutely worked, and nobody doubted it. And it was glorious.
And it worked every day.
Every day, whichever one of us it was. Foolproof.
Or if it was all of us.
Or all of us.
You could pull up. I know there's more than one shot of all four of us standing there with Dusty hitting us all four with the elbow.
Tully, in your opinion, is that like the most classic Crockett rivalry? I mean, when Crockett's business was at its peak, it was like Dusty Rhodes versus the Horseman, was it not?
Yeah, in some form of that, but like Arn was talking about, you know, when I was doing the thing leading up to the I Quit match with Magnum, you know, that thing was just as hot as,
oh, for sure,
as anything else. And then you had Dusty, but then they were tag team partners at times. So you could have a six man, or you'd have a tag team match like that. And, you know, it was just the variety worked. So you didn't have to just have the same two guys wrestle all the time, you know, and it wasn't just Dusty and Flair, and it wasn't just me and Magnum or, you know, Ole and Arn against Rock and Roll or whatever the case might be. We interchanged so well, and like Arn put it so well, that we all had different fortes and strong points that they all just meshed together, because we could adapt a little bit and be the we could be the lubrication between the joints,
right?
If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Let's talk about Jim Crockett. This is a legendary promoter, you know, multiple generations. He's now going to be, you know, top banana in the NWA. And I guess right behind Vince McMahon's World Wrestling Federation. Was that the most fun creatively you had? Was it as financially rewarding as it had been before Crockett, or was that, you know, the peak of your career before, you know, you guys had an impasse in 88, would you say, Tully?
Well, the wrestling business changed because of the Superstation.
Right.
And the thing that, without getting off on a rabbit trail or diving down a rabbit hole, all the smaller territories were affected by what went on the Superstation.
Right.
The farther west, they didn't get affected quite as bad because of the time changes, and they didn't have the 605. But East Coast and Central Time, 605 and 505, it was just unbelievable. And the thing that the smaller territories did that was probably a mistake on their part is they would bring a match in, like Dusty against me. And what that would do would say, these guys are off national television, because we always talked about being on national television. And these are the big time guys on national television, and here's their match versus, and they put them on a main event above their other guys in the local territory. And I think that ultimately killed them all, because if they would have brought Dusty in and wrestled their top heel, you would have made their people up on the same level. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah.
And, you know, so, I mean, I can remember one time I brought Ole and Tommy Rich in. Well, Ole wrestled Wahoo, and I wrestled Tommy Rich into Southwest Championship Wrestling to elevate us. I didn't want to be, you know, have Ole and Tommy Rich wrestling each other. So anyway, and then as you did that, then Crockett took over all these territories. I don't know the whether he bought them or what happened, but now you become the national television forte for wrestling, medium for wrestling. And then with the USA Network, the WWE, which I don't, you probably know, I think Arn does, but Southwest Championship Wrestling that my dad and I put together was the first wrestling show on USA Network.
Wow.
And we were too small and didn't have enough money between the two of us to pay our TV bill. And then Vince went and paid the bill and got the TV time and has been pretty profitable with it since then.
It worked out.
Yes. And, but now you've got the two companies that both have national TV shows. And, then I think in the 90s, which I was gone, but the companies, the TV, the business changed because the TVs became the product rather than the house shows. Does that make sense?
It does. Let's talk a little bit.
I hope I answered your question.
Oh no, for sure. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about the Jim Crockett days, but specifically with the Horseman, you know, when Ole's out, you guys need a new member. Barry Windham becomes the guy. And there was a great piece.
That Luger was the guy first.
Right. Well, Luger felt like, I don't know. Didn't feel like he fit in as well. Would you agree with that? Like just character wise, I'm not saying as a personality.
Arn, you answer that question.
It was real crystal clear to me. The guy looked better than everybody else when Ole went home, and he that was a good angle with him and Tully when Tully called his son a snot nosed kid or something, and Ole whacked him. They got with Ole. I mean, Ole was over. We were all over. And he did his deal, and he went, you know, he disappeared, and Luger was brought in, and hey guys, you know, you guys, if anybody can teach this guy the business, I mean, look at him. And if you take it on point value, yes, here was the difference. Now we had to all circle the wagons. And if Lex was in a match with us, any of us, and they kept him in tags and six mans to protect him, other than spending the majority of our time getting the baby faces over, we had to spend a lot of the time in a match making sure Luger got over. And it's a whole different scheme of things where now we're out there having to get our ass handed to us so Luger can step through the ropes, take a guy's head off, and get the heat. And it was the only way it would have worked. And I don't think, as Lex got more and more popular, all he heard were cheers and boos and female screams because the girls love him. I mean, my God, look at the guy. But I think he had a different plan for himself all along, which is fine. But unbeknownst to us, you know, that plan was to be a lead babyface. And it's not that he put any less work into being a part of us. It's just, you cannot take Ole Anderson out and put Lex Luger in and have the same dynamic. The skill sets are totally different. And the game, and the one thing that I left out earlier, besides all of our styles being different, we went into every match knowing our goal was to, number one, get the baby faces over, number two, get the match over. And it meant being very generous a lot of nights, even overly generous. But once you get over, you can reach down and pull a guy up, you know, in a match or in an angle or something, but you got to get over first. And I think the biggest thing was Lex's heart was not in being a heel. It was not in being part of the Horsemen. He wanted a single spotlight, and eventually he got there.
With a tremendous angle making Barry Windham the fourth member of the Horsemen, which was genius.
Is that a Dusty Rhodes idea, to the best of your recollection?
I think it would have probably had to be, but I would have think he would have asked us what we thought about Barry. It just seems like that's something that would have happened. And if you've been, we had all been in the ring with Barry Tully probably more than any of us, but with his skill set, you know, swapping Luger for Barry Windham from a match standpoint, there was no comparison.
Yeah, no comparison. Well, and what happened, Conrad, there is the dynamics of the four of us changed, because when it first started, Ole and Arn were the tag team, and Flair and I were singles. And when Barry came in, because his talent level was up equal to Flair or even surpassed Flair, then that made him and Flair the two singles. And it put me and Arn in the situation that we became the tag team. And that's how, and you know, I mean, it was, I think time can tell, but I mean, we were a pretty good tag team.
I think right here is a good spot, because if you don't do it, it'll get forgotten, but it's absolutely true. The one dynamic that benefited every team that worked for Jim Crockett was the Rock and Roll Express.
Yes, sir.
You stepped through those ropes and had a match with those guys. If you couldn't get pure, unadulterated, come over the rail, get in the ring heat with those guys, then you couldn't get heat. And every team they worked with was better the next day for having worked with them. And I know they don't get enough credit, but they made, just like on the other side of the ball, we made everybody we worked with, they did exactly the same thing. Ricky and Robert were phenomenal. And it didn't matter who you booked them with, send them to any town, they drew a ton of money too.
Oh gosh. They were a phenomenal team. And I don't know if there ever has been, or before or since, but in Greensboro, we wrestled those guys for an hour inside a cage match, which cage matches are not supposed to go 60 minutes. And the people were just as excited at the first as they were at the end.
The Rock and Roll Express or the Midnight Express, Tully, who did you think you had better matches with? Not just as a fan watching, who did you enjoy more, but in the ring, who was more fun to work against? Because when you guys got going in 88, I think a lot of fans thought, man, heel versus heel, this is like a whole new world here. The Arn and Tully versus the Midnights. And then it got cut short, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But did you enjoy your matches against a super baby face like, you know, Ricky and Robert, or the heel Midnight Express better?
Well, it is the Midnights were awesome guys, and a heel match is a different dynamic. But I mean, to go out and beat up Ricky Morton and have Gibson come in and come beat you up is, it doesn't get any better than that.
No argument for me. All time greats. It's a shame that, both teams aren't in the WWE Hall of Fame, but I'm sure there will be soon enough. Let's talk about that fallout though, that led to you guys going to work for Vince. Of course, we're just getting started with the whole Midnight Express angle, but I know that the WWF has really done a number on Jim Crockett Promotions, counter programming their pay-per-views and things like that. So Arn and I have talked a lot on the show about how there were just some financial things that were promised that weren't actually delivered. And you guys had had enough and said, okay, that's it. And, I think you went and met with Vince McMahon. What can you tell me about your frustration with Jim Crockett Promotions that ultimately said, okay, this is the straw that broke the camel's back. We should see if we can get another deal here.
Well, I mean, basically that was it. We were being used and abused. Wrestling fans are still watching, but I mean, we're having to give in every match, as Arn's already talked about, and they're negotiating for Turner to buy the company, and they're giving contracts out and guaranteed contracts and stuff like that. And they left out Arn and I, and, which was pretty much of a tactical error. And so we had the opportunity to go, and fly up privately and meet with Vince. And, you know, we went to his house and we didn't talk dollars. I don't think we did. I don't remember it if we did. But that we would get a push or whatever, and that we could do whatever. And then, we were being interviewed as key employees with the Turner people. And in my bluntness, the guy was asking me questions and they told me to tell the truth. So I did. And, I made a few comments about some of the network, some of the markets that we were losing ratings in. And I said, this is why we're losing ratings. And, Crockett called me on the phone and told me that I wasn't loyal. And so they kicked me off the airplane.
Was that Jim or David who made the call?
Oh, Jim.
Okay.
We were in Houston, Texas, and, they were passing out next week's who's on the plane and who's booking sheet. And I looked at it and my name wasn't on the plane list. And I think I snapped. Arn would be a much better person to tell, 'cause he was right there watching. And I don't know if I had a temper tantrum or whatever. I just said, okay, I'm done. I quit. Do you want the belts tonight or tomorrow night in Philadelphia? And I was done. And I didn't expect Arn to come with me, but I was done.
So to recap, you felt that you'd been booked unfairly, that they were taking advantage of you, and you're putting everybody over every night. Maybe you'd been slighted on a payoff. We've detailed that on Arn's show in the past. And now, with seemingly there's a life vest coming for the Crocketts, they're passing out guaranteed contracts to other teams and other managers, and you guys don't get that opportunity. So you feel slighted again, and then you're kicked off the plane, and that's enough. You had had enough.
I didn't need to be spanked.
Right. And I think Arn tells the story that when you guys come back from meeting with Vince, you go give notice to Dusty and drop the belts that night to the Midnights. Is that right, Tully?
Well, that was the night before in Houston with what I said.
Okay.
And I didn't know that Arn was going to go with me.
The next morning, Tully, is when we got up. I called Darso. He called me back. They put two plane tickets for us, and we got up that morning after flying in from Houston to Philly. We got up the next morning and flew up to Vince's. That was okay. The time frame. And we met out by the pool. We did discuss money. He didn't promise us what we would make, but he asked what we make prior. And he said, oh, no problem. I'll certainly do better than that. Was one of the things he said. We flew back to Philly, went in that night when it was time to get there and turned in our notice. And it was me supporting my partner, you know, and there were so many things that had snowballed, everything from, you know, if you go back to Houston that night, we had a dark match where the Midnight Express went out there for 20 minutes, tore the joint down. I come back through the curtain. Was it 2 or 3 minutes? Jimmy comes over and says, was it Jimmy? Somebody came over and said, hey, you got to work again. You were Steve Williams, 4 minutes, you know, Williams over. So I called Jimmy in there. I said, what's going on? What am I being punished? Or he said, hey, I'm Arn. I'm just, going with the flow here. And, that was abuse to me. I think it shed on me. Not that I could beat Steve Williams. I couldn't beat Steve Williams with a flamethrower. That's not the question. It shed on the Midnight Express, and it shed on Tully and I that we had just went out and in a competitive match tore the joint down, and now you're just going to squash me, you know, just like I'm a guy that showed up that works at Piggly Wiggly during the week, you know, and that it all was snowballed into pay-per-view payoffs that never came to fruition. There were so many things that happened that just weren't right. And if you wrote them down on the paper and looked at them, reasons we left, if you took down everything, it wouldn't be hard to believe that those guys were getting the shaft. And, you know, we all remember bits and pieces of things, but there was a lot of things that were very clear that happened right before we left.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, you know, you dropped the belts that night and to your old pals, the Midnight Express. And I think fans were pretty excited about what that could have been. It was cut short, but now there's a new experience, the Titan experience, if you will. Tully, when you find out, hey, they're putting us with Bobby Heenan, that's gotta be pretty exciting, right? That means you're going to be top guys.
That was the ingredient that was very, very promising. Bobby was a longtime friend because my dad would bring Nick Bockwinkel down, and Bobby was Nick Bockwinkel's manager for all those years with the AWA. And so it was, I'd got to know him a little bit, but you know, it was a neat experience. The thing that would have been probably a greater experience for us is if he would have worked with us every night. He worked with us on TV and big shows, and he didn't travel with us during the week, which was fine. I mean, Arn and I can certainly function without a manager, but it would have been it might have had a lot more entertainment backstage for us if he'd have been there all the time rather than just at TV.
So you guys come in, you're put with Bobby Heenan. Very quickly, you're going to be in some pretty high profile matches. You guys are working with Demolition and the Hart Foundation, but it feels like a much different presentation than working, you know, down south, as they like to say, in New York. What was the difference in the tag team style that you used with, say, the Midnights or the Rock and Rolls or the Road Warriors versus now you're with the Rockers and the Hart Foundation and Demolition? Was it same thing, just a different style ring, or was it totally different, Tully?
No, it wasn't totally different, in my opinion. We just had to re-educate the guys that we worked with, as well as wrestling fans, that the stuff was Vince never really pushed tag teams,
right?
And we had the opportunity to change that. And so it was, you know, we had great matches with the Rockers. I don't know that we had great matches with the Sheepherders. We had good matches with the Sheepherders, but I don't know that they might have been great. The Hart Foundation, because of the people that were in it and the amount that they were over, we had good matches with them. We had good matches with Demolition, and but the thing that everybody that worked for Crockett knew that they were going to be featured, and we would make them look better than they can make themselves look. And that was our reputation. It wasn't any question about it. And the people working for the New York office didn't have that. I don't know that they had ever had anybody worry about their stuff rather than everybody worried about their own stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Arn, did I hit that nail on the head, or?
Yeah. The biggest thing right off the get go is they said, we don't want you doing this.
Mm.
Day one, go to the ring, do not do this. And I think it was Jack Lanza. So that wasn't created through their company. They didn't want it. We were starting over. The blessing was they didn't give us some terrible costuming, some goofy catchphrases, goofy costuming. We were pretty much the Horseman with a different name. And that was the main thing I was worried about. And, you know, Vince even said one time, he said, you guys lend credibility to my company, which was the biggest compliment that he ever gave us. But we, you know, the one thing we did have to learn is they had a definite pecking order there, and teams were positioned underneath in the middle, top teams. And what was not appreciated was from the get-go, whether it was Roma and Powers or whoever it was, we went out and tried to have too good a match, and we were still learning. Hey, apparently I was still learning, because I thought going out having the best match possible, so did Tully, was the right thing to do, but not with those guys. There were certain teams that, you know, if Demolition worked with them, they just ate them up. And we made a couple of mistakes early about selling too much for certain teams who had been beaten to death. Barry Darso grabbed me the first curtain. You know, first time we came through the curtain, he goes, come with me over here. He says, man, cut out all those bumps. We don't do that up here. Well, I figured it out the next day, because that ring was hard. It was bigger and it was harder. And buddy, if you're going to wrestle as many times as those guys did, and I would soon learn how much they traveled, how many skipping across the country and around the world for that matter on those planes, you didn't go out there and have a 4-star match some nights. Just wasn't supposed to be. And it's all stuff that we picked up pretty quickly. And obviously having Bobby, all he had to do was just look at the crowd and they started the weasel stuff. Piece of cake.
Yeah.
Tully, when you guys were up there, you know, one of the things we've talked about with Arn is how brutal the travel schedule was compared to when you worked for Crockett. Can you give us a glimpse into what that schedule looked like? Because we've heard from you a lot on like old WWE DVDs where you talked about the crazy horseman lifestyle where you guys would wake up here, do the show, fly to Vegas, party all night, fly back the next morning, do another show, fly back to Vegas. This crazy jet setting lifestyle started with the horseman, but now, man, you're on 6 a.m. flights all over the world, right?
Oh, gosh. It was, yeah. If there was an earlier flight, you were on the earlier flight. And, oh my gosh, it was crazy. And we were on, 14-day tours. We were supposed to be 14 on, 3 days off, 5 days on, 3 days off, 14 on, and like that. But it seemed like we were on 14 off 3 days on 14, but you had to, not only did you have to fly home on your first day off of your 3 days. So it seemed like they did it on purpose. We were either in Vancouver or Portland, Oregon. I remember one time we were up in Nova Scotia, which is a 3-hour flight to Boston, flying back to Charlotte. And then you had to buy your own ticket to get home. And then when you'd, depending on where your tour started, you had to fly out either the night. I think we flew out the night before. So you're really, your 3 days off are really a day and a half off. But we might have flew out on Monday. I mean on the morning of our next show. I don't really remember. It has been a while.
Yes, it has been a while. Tully, when did you realize, hey man, this might not be all it's cracked up to be? I'm not saying I necessarily want to run back and work for Jim Crockett Promotions, but thankfully that's not a thing anymore. Turner's running the show, but I don't know what I got to do, but I got to get off this crazy train of working for Vince McMahon and being in a different town every single day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we were in a different town every night, basically with the other company too, but the private planes made it a little bit easier flying home and, that kind of stuff. But it was hard work wrestling, you know, every night, but that's when the live audience was your product. Mm-hmm. And the TV show was the infomercial. And when that all changed, it changed the way the business is. But it was, you know, I don't remember. I know when Arn and I wrestled the first time in the Garden against the Rockers, we had to go 20-minute time limit match, and probably the biggest major tactical error that I ever did was when I came back through the curtain. Hogan looked at me and said, "What am I supposed to do now?" And I said something smart aleck, and don't remember exactly what it was, but we were never on before the main event ever again. We were never on another Hogan card ever again.
Oh.
And but it was, they were running three towns a night. We became the main event guys in the third towns. and the third town started making money instead of losing money.
Wow.
So it was, it wasn't a bad thing, but we were making the same money we were making for Crockett. So it was a lateral move.
Right.
And,
without the perk of a private plane now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and the Horseman, Crockett did fly the Horseman first class when they were on commercial flights, which that was roasty toasty and a good thing. But, it was just a thing where, they reached out, after Turner bought Crockett, they reached out to us. No, I called. Arn, wasn't it? We called when we were in Denver.
I don't remember where we were.
We'd wrestled in Sacramento the night before and drove back to San Francisco to catch a flight to Denver. And we had talked about going, calling them and asking if they want to put the Horsemen back together. And so the next morning, I think it was Denver, may not have been, but I called up and asked for Barnett. And I said, Jim, I said, do you want to put the Horsemen back together again? And he said, I'll call you back in 5 minutes. And the phone rang, and he didn't say anything other than $750,000 each for 3 years. And I said, okay. And did I call you, or were you in the room with me, Arn?
I think you called me.
Yeah. And that was more money than I had ever thought about making, and we agreed to it. And spent the next 3 months trying to get out of New York.
And Arn tells the story that you went and tried to have a conversation with Vince, and Vince basically said, stick with me. And I feel like you had heard that sort of song and dance before with Crockett. And you try to do that, but then ultimately wind up making the decision, we do need to go ahead and leave. How do you remember that going down, Tully?
It's all kind of a mishmash, because that's all in that process when, in that process, we'd given the notice, and then he made a big deal about us staying for Survivor Series, cause we were on, we were on Andre's team. And, so it was so on and so forth. And then that's when I flunked the urine test, in Philadelphia, but they didn't tell me until a week and a half later after we had done the TV, cause they wanted to beat me up on TV.
Mm.
And, so I thought that was good, but anyway, but that's, I got to say it on Jericho's podcast, but that's the only thing, I don't have a problem with me not being in the business. My life has been fine. My only, and I have very few regrets in life, but when my drug test affected Arn, that broke my heart. And, he had to make some decisions, it was not a stellar moment for me. And, cause it was, I didn't even get high. All I did was lick the inside of a bag.
I wish I'd have got
hammered.
I think, in my quick research, you guys were at a wrestling challenge taping in Wichita, Kansas at the Kansas Coliseum, November 1st, 1989.
Yeah.
That's when it all sort of came to a head. We recently visited, Arn and I have a little thing we got going called adfreeshows.com. It's like a super site for behind the scenes stuff on all of our podcasts that we work on. And we caught up with Jim Herd, and, Jim Herd, of course, is one of the guys who's controlling things for Turner when you guys were supposed to make the jump back. And ultimately he reneged on the deal that he had, not only for Arn and reduced the pay, but I guess he sort of helped end your wrestling career, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, he didn't, they used it as leverage on Arn and didn't offer me anything. And I, just so you know, I'm the very first professional wrestler ever to flunk a drug test and not go back to work.
I mean, yeah, I think that's what's been so tragic as a wrestling fan is I have to admit, I didn't really, you know, when all of this was happening, I was 8 years old. So I was a little Hulkamaniac and didn't know anything or anybody. But when I get older and I go back and I look at tapes, I don't know, as a teenager, I start to have a newfound appreciation for the Horseman. And then it just feels like one day in all of my tapes, where did Tully go? And then you pop back up on AEW and everybody collectively looked at their arms and said, oh, I just got chill bumps. Where has this guy been? And it is one of the great, like, missed opportunities as a fan. Like, we were robbed of a really, really great run as a fan. I can't imagine how, and I'm so thankful to hear that you did have a great life and it worked out so well for you. And it's a happy ending and has a great story. But as a fan, I can't help but be a little miffed that we missed some really, really good years.
Well, I was miffed for a while, especially when I couldn't pay my house payment and couldn't pay my car payment. And I was a little miffed too. So
in hindsight, you know, it all worked out the right way, but you had to carry a lot of hard feelings for a long time. Do you place most of that blame on Vince McMahon, Jim Herd, or did you just get to a place where you said, it's on me, I did it, it is what it is?
Oh, it's, well, I mean, I'm the one that made the stupid, idiotic decision. And you know, so I mean, it's, you can't put the blame on anybody else about your life.
Right.
You know, I mean, the only thing in the whole deal, Arn can blame me for being an idiot, but you know, Arn's came out of life as very successful, but it was hard for him just to take the friggin' pay cut that Herd hammered on everybody. You know, but all in all, I wouldn't change what I did because that's how I met Christ.
Right.
And that whole night when Flair called me and told me they found about the drug test and they're not going to offer you the deal, they reneged on the deal, was the night at 4:03 in the morning when I asked Jesus to come into my life. And it was the first time I'd ever said the name Jesus when I wasn't cussing somebody.
Right.
And so from that point, you, over the next 3, 4, 5 years, when I was learning how to walk with the Lord, how I was learning how to forgive, how I was learning how to not hold grudges, I mean, that was a daily chore. And but as I'm now 30 years past the deal and pinching myself because, gosh, I'm on TNT.
Right. It all worked out. Arn, I'm curious, you know, we haven't, you sort of just been a bystander here for the last several minutes of our conversation. Did it fracture your relationship with Tully for a bit when all of this happened and you caught some shrapnel as a result?
Well, like he said, you know, everybody makes mistakes. A guy flunks a drug test. He goes home for 90 days. He's back.
Right.
People will tell you a lot of things about me, you know, smart ass, indignant, what have you. But I've never been called a liar or a swerver because I've never felt the need to do that. And the thing that bothered me the most is we went to work on a handshake deal with Vince McMahon. The reason we left is at the point in the fiscal year, we were $50,000 behind what we had made for Crockett. We called it to his attention, gave him the opportunity to make it right, just catch us up to where we were, and we'll go forward. He said, give me till the next TVs to think about it. In good faith, we went out every night and busted our ass and still gave his product everything we had. 3 weeks later, we walked in. He said, well, guys, I've looked it over. I can't write you both a check for 50 grand. I just can't do that. So I'm going to let you work your notice out. So, you know, when you lose faith again, when you get lied to again, then the deal comes up, you know, that we have that has been, you know, Rick was one of the guys that was in there and going to back for that deal too. So now I get to Atlanta with no forewarning, and I walk in, sit down with Jim Hurd, and he says, I got some bad news, Arn. It was just this callous. He said, you know, Tully flunked the drug test, and quite frankly, you guys are not worth as much as a single. You're not worth as much as a single as you guys were worth as a team. So I'm going to have to cut your money off the 3 years, you know, 100 grand a year. Or whatever it was, 150 grand, whatever it was. It went down to 156, 200, 250, whatever the math is on that. So he said, and I can see on your face, you're disappointed. So if you want to go back to Vince, I understand. Now that's the stupidity that I've left Vince McMahon, who he did use us well. It was a question of dollars and cents.
Right.
You know, I left there to come here, and already the guy is hitting me with that shot, which tells me he knows nothing about our business, nothing about humanity, nothing about being a leader of a company. You know, of all those big contracts they were handing out, and he had to, you know, chop mine off like that. And I went, Mr. Hurd, I don't think you understand. I just worked a 90-day notice. You don't just turn around and walk in the door with a tail between your legs and say, can I come back? You know what his answer would have been? Yeah, I'm glad to have you back. I'd have been beat by every sparrow that was flying around the building the next day. Or maybe a lizard that was crawling up the wall. They would have figured out a way to beat me with that guy. You just don't do that. And that was the thing that just infuriated me. I hadn't done anything wrong. Done everything right by everybody, and you still get it shoved up your ass. It's a little tough pill to swallow.
Tully, over the years, you flirted with the idea of doing more stuff in wrestling. I think we saw you at that Legends of Wrestling pay-per-view, cut a great promo against Stan Lane, and you looked as good as ever in the ring. And once upon a time, I think you thought you might try your hand as being an agent, maybe with WWE. But ultimately, it wasn't ever really the right fit until AEW. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is. You know, I started in my life as doors would open in front of me, I would not prematurely say, no, I'm not going to do it. So I would go towards the door. But my prayer was, if this is not something I'm supposed to do, for God to shut the thing.
Yeah.
And so when I went up to New York for a 2-day deal, I mean, they weren't even offering me a job, because when you get offered a job, they offer you dollars, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get paid this for this amount of work. And so I was just there for 2 days to kind of, and I don't really know what it is, but they never offered me anything. They did fly me up there, and I left there immediately for, we were doing a prison event in North Florida in the Panhandle, Mariana. And I said, well, I know that that's not going to happen. And so I figured my entrance in the wrestling business, other than autograph shows or something like that was over with at that point. And then I got in shape to go do Fujinami's retirement match, which I was never in Japan. So, I mean, that was kind of a neat little trip over there.
Sure.
And, but you know, I'd had very, very little, involvement in the wrestling business until they called and they put the Four Horsemen in the Hall of Fame, which was a nice trip. And, which I was kind of going with what Vince's relationship was with us. Never really understood that, but certainly am glad that I was part of it. And my children were all born after my wrestling career, and all four of my kids were able to be there in Miami when we were there. So that was a very neat deal. And so all good stuff.
It is good stuff. I'm curious, how was your conversation with Vince after all those years when you went back into the Hall of Fame?
Well, there really wasn't any conversation with Vince. I know that we went and took a picture with him in his dressing room,
yep,
which I have on the wall, him holding up four fingers. That's
pretty
that's,
cool.
That's a pretty good one. And then you got Triple H and Shawn Michaels holding up four fingers and another one. I have that picture up too. But it was, you know, I can remember we were standing in the hallway, I think, and Vince was addressing, I think, all of us. And he said, some of you guys absorb all this that's going on because you won't ever be back. And I kind of took it that he was talking to me. So
that's a weird,
everybody else has gone back.
That's a weird thing to say, is it not?
I don't know.
I'm curious. Have you, since the, when you left Jim Crockett Promotions back in 88, have you talked to Jimmy Crockett since?
Yeah, I saw Jimmy, he was going to put some sort of a TV thing back together.
In like 93, you know, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
And, he wanted me to come and help do that. And then that didn't last very long.
Did you ever officially meet Jim Herd in person or just over the phone?
I don't know that I ever met or talked to Jim Herd. The guy that made the offer was Jim Barnett.
Right.
When we were on the road, I don't think I ever met Jim Herd.
Wow. And I know there's rumor and innuendo out there, and Arn, I don't think me and you've ever talked about this, but when Paul Roma became a horseman, supposedly they were in negotiations with you, Tully. Is that the way that actually happened, or is that just dirt sheet stuff that became wrestling lore?
No. They were what Ole, I think, was the booker at the time. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know. I think they contacted me, and I said, okay, I don't know if it was a money thing or not, but there was not really a job offer. But they kept insinuating that I would be there on TV. I sent a registered letter to their office to let them know that I wouldn't be there because they hadn't negotiated any money or anything like that. And I literally sent that. And then it's the only pay-per-view that I've ever bought. I bought that to see how they would explain me not showing up. And, it was probably as big a flop of anything because the fans were expecting me to come out.
Yeah.
And Paul Roma came out, and it really wasn't fair to him.
No,
but the audience didn't like it at all, I don't think.
Arn, what do you remember about that?
Well, I was excited that I had heard he was coming back. You know, I never asked what anybody make.
Right.
It's none of my business. All I'm concerned with is what I make.
Yeah.
And I just heard there was a stall. No one was specific. I know that it had already been put out there and that Tully was coming back. And there's, let's just face it, you know, nobody was in second place. You could have brought Hulk Hogan out there and put him in that spot. It would not have been received like it would have been with Tully.
Right.
And it wasn't fair to Paul. He was put in a ridiculous situation. And it just started to go downhill. Every concoction, every version of the Horseman from that day forward just started to get used less and less and devalued. And it was just a placeholder on the card. And it was basically the only thing that was over anymore was the name. That was it. That and this, you know, the group was not over. We weren't used in a capacity that we could get over because we were just, you know, midway to first match after intermission. And when you get bumped down the ladder, I guess you could just say, the fans know it and they see it. And now you're a middle guy. You're not a top guy anymore. And that's basically what happened.
Well, we're all top guys for getting to listen to this today. It's so cool to catch up with you guys and just listen to you talk about your shared experiences. Tully, any final words before we wrap this up, man? I just want to tell you, as a fan, I still absolutely love seeing you on Wednesdays. I know most of the time when you come back through the curtain, you've got a really excited text message for me saying, that's the best promo of the year every time. You're hitting home runs out there, man. And we just enjoy it.
I appreciate it too.
Well, it's good stuff, man. It's so great to see you back.
Well, thank you. And it's a thrill to be back. It really is. And I hope the new wrestling fans can get a little bit of a taste of what it used to be like.
Well, you're making that happen. Arn, we're dropping this just a couple of days before Christmas. I guess today's Christmas Eve's Eve. You want to send everybody home with a happy Christmas song or something? Do you want to sing us out?
No. Just would like to say, you know, guys, take this opportunity to just stay home with your family. You know, don't venture out, please. Don't travel. All the things that we're being told on the news every night, you know, let's get that turned around. I'm sick to death of bad news. We try to bring you, you know, some relief from bad news because that's all we hear every single night. And let's do our part, you know, wear your mask, do your distancing, wash your hands, you know, don't go in gatherings where a bunch of people that you don't know, it's just stupid. You know, let's help those nurses and doctors who have given their lives basically to us to help fight this thing off. Let's at least do them the honor of doing what they request. Everybody have a happy holidays. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, whatever your thing is, just enjoy it. And we look forward to seeing you after first of the year. Thanks for being with us this entire year.
Thank you for all your support. And hey, thanks for tuning in today. And Mr. Blanchard, can't thank you enough. Thank you so much for taking time with us today.
Thank you, Conrad. Merry Christmas.
So long, everybody.